This is also true of people who have suffered debilitating accidents. A few years after the accident, despite long-term effects such as paralysis, accident victims were about as happy as they were before this life-changing event, again, despite the general affective forecast that they would be much unhappier. Two concepts are used to explain these peculiar findings: focalism and presentism. Focalism is the tendency to underestimate the extent to which other events will influence our thoughts and feelings in the future. Presentism, as you might guess, addresses the fact that we put too much emphasis on the present in our predictions of the future. Taken together, this means that we focus on our current situation and how we feel now, without enough consideration about the future situation, what might happen, and how we might feel then, or have in similar situations in the past. Here are some common experiences of this. If we go grocery shopping after a meal, we will generally underestimate how much we will eat in the week ahead and buy less. Addicts who have just ingested their drug of choice will underestimate how much they will crave the drug later. Irrationally, we think how we are feeling now is how we will feel later. The most astonishing thing about this is that it's true for simple things like current and future hunger states. How is this related to procrastination? We need to consider what this human bias in affective forecasting means to our understanding of procrastination. By this point, the argument may be apparent. In making an intention for future action, we focus on our current affective state with the mistaken assumption that our affective state at the point we expect to act on our intention will be the same as it is now. The real catch here is that when we intend a future action, our affective state is often particularly positive. Why? There are two reasons. First, because we are putting off action until the future, we get the reward that we discussed with giving in to feel good. We feel good now that the intention is for future action. At the very least, we feel relief that we are not on the hook to act now. Second, we are imagining ourselves engaged in some future action that we perceive will make us happy. This is pleasant in and of itself. Health behaviors are good examples here. If we intend to go for a run tomorrow, we feel good about ourselves for making such a proactive, health-related intention. Good for us. Our current affective state is positive, and we incorrectly forecast that our affective state tomorrow, at the intended time of the run, will be the same. There is nothing like a righteous intention now for action later to make us feel good. I'll run tomorrow. I'll do that assignment tomorrow. I'll write that report later. Happiness now, pay later, or not, as the case may be. Unless we can get better at mental time traveling, where we can set intentions with clearer knowledge about how we will feel about taking action in the future, we will continue to be predictably irrational with our procrastination. Strategies for change. We need a two-pronged approach to increase the likelihood that we will act on our intentions. One strategy is time travel. The other is to expect to be wrong and deal with it. Strategy number one, time travel. As numerous psychologists who study affective forecasting have advocated, we need to use mental images of the future more often and more accurately. We need to represent the future as though it were happening in the present. For example, a person who is procrastinating on saving for retirement might imagine, as vividly as possible, living on his or her potential retirement savings. To make a future image like this one more concrete and accurate, it may be important to set out some numbers for a budget and to take into account the reality of the need for and increasing expense of healthcare in old age. This time travel can help make our predictions of the future more accurate and motivate us to take more appropriate action now. Unfortunately, I'm not that confident that this approach will work for many people. First, it is possible that we will put off this planning task itself a form of second-order procrastination. Second, even if we do this task, the initial emotional response, for example, fear, will most likely wear off quickly, and more important, the fact that retirement is so far away may still result in us discounting its importance and delaying our savings further. Strategy number two, expect to be wrong and deal with it. This second strategy is more effective, but you may think that it is a hard-nosed approach. In this case, rather than trying to change what seems to be a deeply ingrained bias in human thinking by improving our affective forecasts, I think we should simply learn to expect to be wrong and go from there. We do this every day with respect to weather forecasts, and most recently, we've been learning to do this with ridiculously inaccurate economic forecasts. Given our ability to cope with inaccurate meteorological and economic forecasts, I have confidence we can cope effectively with our poor affective forecasting. This strategy, by necessity, takes two forms or approaches. Approach number one. When we are tempted to procrastinate on a current intention or task, thinking that we'll feel more like it tomorrow, we need to stop and think, no, that's the problem with my forecasting. There is a good chance I won't feel more like it tomorrow. And it's important to add the following. My current motivational state does not need to match my intention in order to act. This is a common misperception about goal pursuit. We believe that we have to actually feel like it. We don't. And with many of the tasks in our lives, we won't feel like it. Ever. The thing is, our motivational state does not need to match the intention. We can do something even if we don't feel like it. Parents spend a lot of time explaining this to their children. Here is another example. Much as we might prefer a sunny day to go out for a run or a bike ride, we can put on rain gear and get outside. In fact, successful athletes do this every day. They are not fair-weather trainers. The weather does not have to match the activity. We can cope with what we get and still act as intended. Similarly, acknowledging that our motivational state is neither necessary nor sufficient to ensure action, we can simply remind ourselves of our personal goals, a form of self-affirmation, and just get started. Progress will fuel well-being and enhance goal attainment. I have more to say on this in Chapter 6. Approach number two. When we set an intention to act tomorrow, and tomorrow comes, expect that you probably will not feel overly enthused to get started. Given that our intention was made yesterday or much earlier, with the optimistic mood that comes with having a plan, we'll probably feel less happy than we expected with the reality of the task now at hand. Again, this is all part of our biased affective forecasting. Now, the thing to do is to remember that this is a transient mood, and think through all of the issues raised with approach number one, particularly how your motivational state does not need to match the task for you to get started right now. This is tough love with oneself, I suppose. Certainly, many of us have heard this advice as we are growing up. It was couched in the terms of maturity and the responsibilities of adulthood. These were often expressions of tough love, too. This was advice from adults in our lives who are trying to nurture fortitude and realism with respect to willpower. In sum, the strategy I'm advocating for dealing with our bias toward thinking we'll feel more like it tomorrow is knowing that this is a common problem with being human. We are not very good at predicting how we will feel in the future. We are overly optimistic, and our optimism comes crashing down when tomorrow comes. When our mood sours, we end up where I started in the last chapter, giving in to feel good. We procrastinate. The problem is pretty obvious, as is the solution. Let go of the misconception that our motivational state must match the task at hand. In fact, social psychologists have demonstrated that attitudes follow behaviors more than, or at least as much as, behaviors follow attitudes. When you start to act on your intention as intended, you will see your attitude and motivation change. This gets me a little bit ahead of my story, however. For now, let's keep the focus on the mantra for this chapter. I won't feel more like doing it tomorrow. Chapter 5. Excuses and Self-Deception. How our thinking contributes to our procrastination. I need to be aware of my rationalizations. Alan lamented his procrastination to anyone who would listen, but nothing seemed to change. His friends recognized him as the master of excuses, although Alan didn't acknowledge his own hidden talents here. He was truly the Teflon guy when it came to being accountable, even to himself. Nothing stuck to him. There was always an excuse for waiting another day, and there was always an excuse for being off task. It's not due for weeks. I can do that work in a few hours. I work better under pressure. Of course, another day always became another, and soon weeks or months passed without progress. Why couldn't Alan see how he was just rationalizing this needless delay? Issue. In addition to understanding our basic impulse to give in to feel good, as discussed in Chapter 3, and not really feeling more like doing it tomorrow, as we discussed in Chapter 4, we need to consider some of the biases in our thinking. There are a number of very important issues to consider, including the human tendency to 1. Discount future rewards in relation to short-term rewards, 2. Underestimate the time things will take and overestimate how much we can do, 3. Prefer tomorrow over today, 4. Self-handicap to protect self-esteem, 5. Think irrationally about the task at hand and our ability to accomplish the task, and 6. Manufacture our own happiness by changing our thinking to be consistent with our behavior. Books have been written about each of these topics, but true to the digest nature of this audio program and the promise to provide you with what you need now, I have summarized each of these problems in the sections that follow. Of course, this is followed by strategies for change. Discounting future rewards over short-term rewards. Future rewards, particularly those in the more distant future, seem smaller in size. It's as if we're looking at a picture of a distant mountain and assuming that it's actually small. We do not seem to have perspective for size when time is involved. This is the notion of discounting future rewards, also known as temporal discounting. The problem is that future rewards seem less attractive to us than immediately available ones. I guess this should not surprise us too much. From an evolutionary perspective, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Our brains seem programmed to prefer immediate rewards. This Stone Age brain is not so adaptive in our modern world, where we need to meet distant deadlines by doing things today. The planning fallacy. It is also human nature to be overly optimistic. We assume we can get more done in less time than is reasonable, and we assume tasks will take less time than they usually do. This is at the heart of the issue. We are not really thinking about how long things usually take based on past experience. We focus on the singular event we are facing without taking into account distributive information about experience or similar events. What results from this optimistic bias is poor planning. Self-handicapping to protect self. To self-handicap is to provide an excuse for oneself. For example, if you were to wear weighted shoes and have a running race with a friend, your ability or competence as a runner would never come into question. If you lose the race, it is the fault of the handicap, the heavy shoes. If you win the race, however, that is extraordinarily meritorious. It is win-win for the individual's sense of self. Certainly, self-esteem is never threatened. A similar situation can arise with procrastination. To the extent that we delay work on a task to the last moment, we can be creating another form of self-handicapping. As with the running race, a task done at the last minute can be excused if not done well because it was done in such a short amount of time. And, of course, if the task is done very well, it looks exceptionally good for the individual. This implies that the needless delay of a task that we defined as procrastination may in fact fill a need. It can protect self-esteem. An experimental research by Joseph Ferrari, DePaul University, indicates that chronic procrastinators in particular prefer not to have feedback about self if they have the choice. Of course, delay of this sort has begged the question of whether this is truly procrastination at all, because it can be seen as a strategic use of delay. But it is worth including here just to acknowledge that we can end up delaying our tasks for reasons that may not at first seem apparent. Preferring tomorrow over today. Here is an example of a relation that we all understand. If B is greater than A, and C is greater than B, then we can assume that C is also greater than A. This is known as a transitive relation. What about this example? Imagine a task is due on Friday. It is now Monday morning. It is preferable to work on this task Tuesday as opposed to Monday. In other words, the preference for Tuesday is greater than the preference for Monday. Tuesday arrives. It's preferable to work on this on Wednesday as opposed to Tuesday. Wednesday arrives. Again, it's preferable to work on this Thursday instead of Wednesday. So far, so good. These are transitive relations. Then Thursday arrives. Oops, we think it's now preferable that we had begun on Monday. This is known as an intransitive preference. Krisula Andrew, a philosopher at the University of Utah, has argued that when it comes to procrastination, this is a common problem with our thinking. Certainly many health behaviors and retirement saving plans suffer from this problem with our reasoning. It comes to a point when tomorrow is not only less preferred, but then an earlier date is actually the preferred date and is now too late to act. Many of us know this relation from experience. Studies from our research group also bear this out. We get a reversal of our preferences that makes for an intransitive preference structure. The problem is that the intransitive nature of this preference structure works against us in the long run. Tomorrow is not as preferable as we once thought. Our irrational thoughts. We often believe things to be true that are not. We do not challenge these beliefs with any reality testing, so they persist. For example, we might believe that we cannot make any mistakes, or that we have to be able to answer any and every question after a presentation. We might believe we need to be perfect. We might think that our whole self-worth is dependent upon our career success. All of these are examples of irrational thoughts, and they are common and problematic. They can lead us to experience very negative emotions, and they can provide an excuse for not trying. For example, if we are fearful that we cannot do a task perfectly, and that our self-worth depends on this perfect performance, then we may avoid the task to protect our self-esteem. We procrastinate. Manufacturing our own happiness and resolving internal conflict. When our actions and beliefs, or even two beliefs, are in conflict, they are dissonant. Psychologists call this cognitive dissonance. Dissonance is uncomfortable. We want to alleviate this negative state. When we intend to act, when we have a goal towards which we have an intention to act, and we do not act, voluntarily and quite irrationally choosing to delay action, despite knowing this may affect us negatively, we experience dissonance. This dissonance is one of the costs of procrastination. Here are a few typical reactions that researchers have cataloged as responses to dissonance and ways that we reduce this dissonance. 1. Distraction. With distraction, we divert our attention away from dissonant cognitions and avoid the negative affective state caused by dissonance. 2. Forgetting. Forgetting can be in two forms, passive and active. Passive is often the case with unimportant thoughts. Well, we may have to actively suppress important cognitions that are causing dissonance. 3. Trivialization. Trivialization involves changing beliefs to reduce the importance of the dissonance creating thoughts or beliefs. 4. Self-affirmation. Self-affirmation creates a focus on our core values and other qualities that reasserts our sense of self and integrity despite the dissonance. 5. Denial of responsibility. Denial of responsibility allows us to distance ourselves as a causal agent in the dissonance. 6. Adding consonant cognitions. Adding consonant cognition is often done by seeking out new information that supports our position. For example, this isn't procrastination, or I need more information before I can do anything on this project. 7. Making downward counterfactuals. Making downward counterfactuals involves saying things like, or thinking things like, it could have been worse, so we don't learn anything. We just feel better in the short term. 8. Changing behavior. Changing behavior to better align with our beliefs and our values. This means that we would act instead of procrastinating, although changing one's behavior requires effort and is often not the most convenient way to reduce dissonance. We are quite expert at employing these strategies to keep buoyant day to day. We manufacture our own happiness. It is part of our coping mechanisms. That said, not all coping mechanisms are adaptive. Quite consistently, research has demonstrated that techniques like distraction, forgetting, trivialization, and denial of responsibility are emotion-focused strategies that are not nearly as effective in the long term as planful problem-solving strategies. Yes, we have to take care of our emotions, but this cannot be where the coping stops. If it is, that is just another instance of giving in to feel good, and we will pay in the long run if this is our dominant short-term strategy. The myth of the arousal procrastinator. We often hear this, I work better under pressure. This thinking reflects a sensation seeker of sorts, someone who thrives on pressure. The thing is, our research has shown that this is a myth, at least for the majority of people. Sensation seeking is not related to procrastination, and time pressure typically results in more errors. Although many people use the excuse that they work better under pressure to explain their needless task delay, it clearly falls into the category above as an example of a rationalization for the dissonance we feel when we fail to act when intended. Perhaps a more accurate way to rephrase this oft-heard expression is that we only work under pressure. Why? Most probably because of the mistaken belief presented in Chapter 4 that our motivational state must match the task at hand. When we do not feel motivated to work on a task, we put it off until finally the external time pressure to do the task motivates action, typically so late that a poor overall performance is the result. Strategies for change. I have briefly summarized a number of important biases in our thinking that can get us in trouble. On the one hand, we tend to be overly optimistic about the future and minimize the importance of more distant goals. On the other hand, when it finally comes down to doing something, we prefer tomorrow over today and make excuses about not working to make ourselves feel better. Given these psychological processes, change here is not a simple thing, but it is possible. Knowledge is power. Recognizing that it is human nature to have these biases, and more important, identifying specifically what we tend to do can be the beginning of change. For example, if we typically say something like, ah, it's not that important, trivialization of the goal, or there's lots of time yet, so I prefer to do it tomorrow, planning fallacy and intransitive preferences, we can learn to make these flags or signals for change. By flag or signal, I mean that as soon as we say something like, there's lots of time, I can do this later, it acts as a trigger or stimulus for a new response. Remember the earlier example of this as an implementation intention? If we say, ah, it's not that important, then we stop and remind ourselves that this is a form of self-deception, a bias in our thinking, and we just get started on the task instead. This form of implementation intention puts a cue in the situation, even in our thinking, to help us break a habit. The thought becomes the stimulus for a different response. We break our habitual way of responding. We begin to break that pernicious procrastination habit. The takeaway for this chapter, in terms of what you might do now, is to make a list of the things that you commonly say or do to justify your procrastination. You may need to compile this list over the next few days or weeks. The key thing is to learn to recognize how you are reasoning and rationalizing the voluntary, unnecessary delays in your life. Each of these statements can become your own flags to signal a new response. If these are your typical rationalizations or excuses for needless task delay, what will your new response be? In the next chapter, you will see that I think the important step is just get started. So my standard implementation intention is, if I say something to myself like, "Oh, I'll feel more like doing this tomorrow," I will catch myself in this self-deception and add, "Then I'll just get started on the task instead." It works. You'd be surprised. In the next chapter, I explain why. Chapter 6: The Power of Getting Started. Just get started. I don't have to look very far for a story about this topic. My own life supplies many examples daily. When I face a task that I find aversive, a task I simply don't want to do, a task that I find boring or tedious, or even a task for which I have doubts about my competence, it is tempting to walk away. I want to procrastinate. I find myself saying things like this to myself: "I'll feel more like doing this later." This is a flag for me. It is a signal that I have learned to identify that I'm just about to procrastinate. At that very moment, I use this signal to just get started. I will immediately start on anything related to the task at hand. Let's explore why this is so important. Issue. Once we start a task, it's rarely as bad as we think. Our research shows us that getting started changes our perception of a task. It can also change our perception of ourselves in important ways. In a series of studies, my students and I used electronic pagers to gather what is called experience sampling data. We paged research participants randomly throughout the day over a week or two. Each time we paged them, we asked them things like, "What are you doing? Is there something else you should be doing? How are you feeling? What are you thinking?" In addition, depending on the study, we asked the participants to rate what they were doing and what they were supposed to be doing on things like how stressful they perceived the task to be. A rating of 10 indicated extremely stressful, while a 0 meant not stressful at all, and all points in between reflected the variability. This type of data allowed us to take a sort of snapshot through time of what the participants were doing. Importantly, we also got a real-time glimpse of what they were thinking and feeling. Some of our findings were expected. Some surprised us. I have summarized these findings by simplifying the research as a Monday to Friday process and by focusing mainly on the task avoidance. As expected, on Monday, when participants were avoiding some tasks, for example, working on an assignment, in preference to other activities, for example, hanging out with friends, we found they typically said things like, "I'll feel more like that tomorrow," or, "Not today, I work better under pressure." As you learned in the previous chapter, we rationalize the dissonance between our behaviors, not doing, and our expectations of ourselves, "I should be doing this now." Of course, later in the week, none of the participants spontaneously said things like, "I feel like doing that avoided task today," or, "I'm glad I waited until tonight because I work better like this." Surprisingly, we found a change in the participants' perceptions of their tasks. On Monday, the dreaded avoided task was perceived as very stressful, difficult, and unpleasant. On Thursday, or the wee hours of Friday morning, once they had actually engaged in the task they had avoided all week, their perceptions changed. The ratings of task stressfulness, difficulty, and unpleasantness decreased significantly. What did we learn? Once we start a task, it's rarely as bad as we think. In fact, many participants made comments when we paged them during their last-minute efforts that they wished they had started earlier. The task was actually interesting, and they thought they could do a better job with a little more time. Just get started. That is the moral here. Once we start, our attributions of the task change. Based on other research, we know that our attributions about ourselves change too. First, once we get started, as summarized above, we perceive the task as much less aversive than we do when we are avoiding it. Second, if we do not finish the task, we have done something, and the next day, our attributions about ourselves are not nearly as negative. We feel more in control and more optimistic. You might even say we have a little momentum. Research by Ken Sheldon, University of Missouri, Columbia, also demonstrates that progress on our goals makes an important difference. Progress on our goals makes us feel happier and more satisfied with life. Interestingly, positive emotions have the potential to motivate goal-directed behaviors and volitional processes, for example, self-regulation to stay on task, that are necessary for further goal progress or attainment. Very clearly, we can see how, if we prime the pump by making some progress on our goals, the resulting increase in our subjective well-being enhances further action and progress. Of course, this simple advice is not the whole solution to the procrastination puzzle, but it is a crucial first step towards solving it and decreasing our procrastination. In the next chapter, I take us past this initial step. Strategy for change. When you find yourself thinking things like, "I'll feel more like doing this tomorrow. I work better under pressure. There's lots of time left. I can do this in a few hours tonight." Let that be a flag or signal or stimulus to indicate that you are about to needlessly delay the task, and let it also be the stimulus to just get started. This is another instance of the if-then type of implementation intention. I've raised the notion of an implementation intention a few times already, but I've not provided details about what it is. As defined in the Well-Developed Psychology of Action created by Peter Gallwitzer, University of New York, an implementation intention supports a goal intention by setting out in advance when, where, and how we will achieve this goal, or at least a sub-goal within the larger goal or task. It is not as effective to make ourselves a to-do list of goal intentions as it is to decide how, when, and where we're going to accomplish each of the tasks we need to get done. There's an accumulating body of research by Peter Gallwitzer and his colleagues that demonstrates the efficacy of implementation intentions for initiating behaviors, including following through on the intentions to take vitamins, participating in regular physical activity after surgery, and acting on environmentally minded intentions, such as purchasing organically grown foods. In short, implementation intentions are a powerful tool to move from a goal intention to an action. As I have outlined in earlier chapters, these implementation intentions take the form of if-then statements. The if part of the statement sets out some stimulus for action. The then portion describes the action itself. The issue here really is one of pre-decision. We are trying to delegate the control over the initiation of our behavior to a specified situation without requiring conscious decision. If I say to myself things like, "I'll feel more like doing this later," or "I don't feel like doing this now," then I will just get started on some aspect of the work. Notice that we are not using the famous Nike slogan of "just do it." It's about just getting started. The doing it will take care of itself once we get going. If we think about just doing it, we risk getting overwhelmed with all there is to do. If we just take a first step, that is much easier. As a strategy, you may find that you have to just get started many times throughout the day, even on the same task. This is common. Even in meditation, we have to gently bring our attention back to our focal point, whatever that may be, for example, our breath, a mantra. The thing to remember is that just getting started may happen many times in a day. All of our procrastination gets stopped short when we just get started. It's not the whole solution by any means, but it is a huge and crucial first step. As is commonly said, a job begun is a job half done. It is tempting to run away from this strategy, to criticize it because it's exactly your problem. You're not able to get started. Not so. You think you're not able to get started, probably because you're focused on your feelings, which are negative, and you're thinking about the whole task, about getting it done, as opposed to getting started. The trick is to find something that you can get started on. Keep it really simple. Keep it as concrete as possible, too. Research by Sean McRae, University of Constance, and his colleagues has shown that thinking abstractly about our goals leads us to believe that they are not that urgent or pressing. More concrete thoughts about your goal or task, more concrete plans, lead to more timely action. In other words, more concrete plans will help you just get started. An implementation intention helps you get started. It is your pre-decision so that you do not get caught up in thinking, choosing, deciding. You've already made the decision. Now is the time to act. Here is a common example from an academic context. When facing a writing task, perhaps a term paper, it is possible to just sit and stare at a blank computer screen. As you do, anxiety builds, and pretty soon you're giving in to feel good. You're away from your desk another day, and guilt is building fast. So, instead of staring at the blank screen, start typing. Start with a title page. Put your name on it. Add the title if you know it, at least something as a working title. Begin your reference page if you are still not ready to write. Begin jotting down ideas about what you would write about if you could write. You do not have to write sentences, but you can if they come. The thing is, you are now actually working on the task. It is rough, but everything begins that way, rough. Carpenters rough frame houses. Sculptors carve and shape rough surfaces into smooth ones. Farmers disc and harrow rough, plowed fields into fields ready for planting. We are always starting somewhere to work toward the finished product. The other way to think about this is the old saying that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Take that first step. Just get started. It can make all the difference. Honestly, if you're not ready to make this first step to just get started on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, then you should stop listening now. You're not committed to change yet, and nothing else I have to say will matter in your self-change. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to discourage you, I'm just being honest. I will tell you more about other strategies, the role of willpower, and even the effects of our personalities on procrastination in upcoming chapters, but you must know that it will always come down to that precipitous moment when you just get started. It will always come down to that movement from not doing to doing. For tasks that we would rather avoid, this is a difficult but wonderful moment. So we are back to where I began the chapter, with the mantra, just get started. To this, I have added a couple of other phrases that you might want to use as your own personal mantra. These are, prime the pump, a job begun is a job half done, and a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. In closing this chapter, I'd like you to pick a task or a goal that you're procrastinating on and that is really bothering you. Write down as many of the subtasks that you think of that are required to get this task done. Now, looking at that list, indicate which of these is a priority or which subtask makes most sense for you to complete first. This is the place to just get started. However, even with this list of tasks, you may not know how to proceed. This is simply a reality, and it may not be possible to be completely rational in your approach, but you can still get started. Pick a task, any task, and let that suffice. You may even have to flail around a bit, but if you get started, at least you'll find your way. Not starting will guarantee that you will remain stuck. You can take this approach for just about any goal or task that you have. In fact, when you just cannot seem to get started on a task, get started by breaking down the task into subtasks, but don't stop there, as tempting as it may be some days. It is true for many of us that after we make a list like this, we feel better and we think we've accomplished something, so we actually stop. Another excuse for procrastination. Don't forget, the purpose of that list is to get you started. Just get started. Chapter 7, Why Getting Started Isn't the Whole Solution. I need to be prepared to deal with distractions, obstacles, and setbacks. Hans has really been taking his stop procrastinating goal to heart. Today, rather than put off work on his report as he typically has, he just got started. He was surprised at how good he felt. He even felt optimistic about the results. Then, about 45 minutes into his work, the phone rang. Bruce, a friend Hans sees daily, was calling him with an invitation to play squash. Bruce's expected partner had canceled at the last minute, so Bruce was hoping Hans would fill in, even though they had played the day before. Although Hans intended to work through the afternoon, to make up for time he'd already lost, he felt like things were under control now, so he told Bruce he would meet him at 12:30 at the gym. Issue. In the scenario above, Hans's goal was his report, and he made the key first step of getting started. In fact, the night before, Hans had made an implementation intention to begin his work right after he finished breakfast, and he did. He made his pre-decision with, "If breakfast is done, then I will immediately go to my desk and start working on the third section of my report." Note that he had a concrete task for his action with the third section of the report, a section that he felt would be an easy place to begin, even though it was not the beginning of the report itself. He felt very good about finally doing this. At the very least, there is usually a sense of relief when we get to an avoided task. Unfortunately, these good feelings can be a little bit of a trap for us. They can make us feel overly optimistic, and some of our biases in planning and thinking may begin to emerge. In fact, Hans felt his mind begin to wander, and typical thoughts emerged when he was even a little bit stuck in his progress. At one point, when he hit a tough spot in the writing, he caught himself thinking, that's enough for today. I'll feel more like doing this part tomorrow. In fact, he was somewhat relieved when Bruce called. It seemed a perfect excuse to stop. Certainly exercise is important in life too, he thought. What this means in terms of more successful goal pursuit is that we have to recognize other points at which we typically abandon our goal pursuit. We have to be prepared to address each of these as they arise. Otherwise, we'll fall back into habitual ways of responding. If you tend to procrastinate more often than you like, then your habitual response will be to find some way to avoid the task at hand. Procrastination is not just a failure to get started. We can face a variety of problems and needlessly delay at many stages of goal pursuit. Our feelings may still threaten to derail us. Distractions abound, and it's easy to replace one intention with another, even if just for a minute. And in all of this, we can find ways to justify this to ourselves. In the scenario above, the squash invitation can be seen as an unnecessary disruption, given how regularly Hans sees his friend, as well as Hans's intention to work today. Perhaps a more common example for those of us working at our computers is becoming distracted and putting off the task at hand by checking email or surfing the web. I know from my research that internet technologies in particular are potent distractors, as it will only take a minute to check my email, and then hours later you find you're still off task. I discuss this in more detail in Chapter 10. What this means is that we cannot simply depend on our goal intentions, no matter how deeply committed we might be, to keep our volitional actions on track. We have to be prepared to deal with changes in our mood related to setbacks and disappointments. We have to be prepared to deal with distractions. We have to be prepared to overcome obstacles. Given the ongoing challenges to our goal pursuit, we would benefit from implementation intentions related to the potential distractions and obstacles ahead. We can make pre-decisions to help us here, too. Strategies for change. There are two main approaches to pre-decisions regarding potential distractions. The first involves reducing the number of distractions before we begin to work. The second approach takes us back to implementation intentions to help us decide ahead of time what we will do when distractions, obstacles, or setbacks arise. I outline each of these below. Minimizing distractions. Different things distract each of us. Some people cannot work with a radio on in the background or in a noisy room. Others, more extroverted personalities, need that background noise. This means that we have to think about what our typical distractions are. In a world dominated by computer-related tasks and jobs, certainly some of these distractions are other activities on the computer, such as games, social networking tools, web searches, or even just email. I discuss these potent distractions under internet procrastination in the final chapter. For now, I would just add them to our list of potential distractions or obstacles. The key to this strategy of minimizing distractions is to be proactive. Before you begin to work, make sure that you have removed these potential distractions. This might include shutting your door, shutting off the ringer on your phone, shutting off your cell phone. Text messaging is a chronic distraction for many people. Shutting down social networking tools, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, whatever you use, and removing potentially distracting things from your workspace, for example, magazines or newspapers. If you listen to that paragraph again, you will note that shutting is a key verb. You are shutting yourself away from distractions to help maintain your attention and focus on your intended task. This is your pre-decision to help you work. Of course, you cannot anticipate every distraction, obstacle, or setback in your work. For example, Hans did not expect Bruce to call with the invitation to play squash. You will need another strategy to deal with distractions as they arise. That is the purpose of implementation intentions. Implementation intentions. Implementation intentions can work to shield our intentions from competing possibilities, as they can take the form of if-then statements that anticipate distractions. In fact, experimental research by Peter Galwitzer and his colleagues has shown that participants who form temptation-inhibiting implementation intentions outperform the groups who did not. Importantly, this effect was independent of the participants' motivation to achieve the goal and to ignore distractions. Implementation intentions have effects over and above our motivation to succeed. This is important. Commitment and motivation alone will not always get us through. It is time to think about your main procrastinated tasks again. As a closing activity to this chapter, list the kinds of distractions and obstacles that have resulted in further procrastination, even when you have actually been working on the task. For each of these, note whether you can remove it prior to task engagement and/or add an implementation intention as your pre-decision about how you will act when it arises in the future. For example, a potential distraction may be email, and my decision might be, yes, I can shut this off before I work, so I can deal with that proactively. Another example might be the example we had in the chapter of a friend's invitation, and here, an implementation intention may be more effective. For example, if my friends call to invite me out this weekend, then I will immediately say, thanks, but no, I'm committed to finishing my work. A final example might be the common feeling of, I'm stuck on my work and I don't know what to do. Here, an implementation intention might be effective again. If I get stuck, confused, and worried because I don't know what to do, then I will stay put and list what I do know to be sure what it is I don't know. Once I know this, I can seek help if needed. I won't give up. Continue with your own examples, deciding whether you would be proactive or if you would form an implementation intention to deal with potential distraction, obstacles, or setbacks. When you're finished, continue to the next chapter. Chapter 8. Willpower, willpower. If we only had the willpower. Willpower is a limited resource that I need to use strategically. Rachel's exercise goal wasn't becoming a reality. Given her very early start each day to get the kids off to school and out to work herself, She put aside time after dinner to get on the treadmill.